This morning we are going to finish up our study about church, and in particular we're at the very end of chapter 26 of the confession, and we're going to actually cover the last two paragraphs in one Sunday. That really is not advisable. The last paragraph in itself could require months, weeks of teaching at least. But we're not going to do that. We're going to kind of hit the high spots so that we fit in with our schedules that we have. So these last several paragraphs, paragraphs 12, 13, 14, and 15, deal with church problems that occur and what are the biblical solutions to those church problems. We dealt with paragraphs 12 and 13, and they relate to each other as doctrine to practice. Paragraph 12 is the doctrine. Paragraph 13 is the practice. The doctrine is, in essence, you are biblically required to be a member of a church somewhere. Christians are not to be isolated entities. The practice is that as you are a member of a church, if there are offenses that take place within the church, there is a biblical way to handle those offenses. And those are laid out in Matthew chapter 18. So I want to just give a quick summary of this last paragraph, and then we're going to move on to 14 and 15. First, when we talk about church offenses and church problems, we have to understand that these are serious matters. We must be careful that we are not causing someone else to stumble in their faith. And when we talk about Matthew 18, that's what we are dealing with. We're not dealing with issues of you don't like the color of my tie, or you got mad at me and insulted me. We're dealing about sins that arise to the level of where someone looks at what's going on and says, I'm not sure this Christianity stuff is real. Or it's capable of doing that. It's liable would be the word. Maybe it's an outsider, someone outside the church who knows of sin inside the church. And as a result, their perspective is, you know, if that's what Christianity is, I don't think I want a part of it. When David commits adultery with Bathsheba, do you remember Nathan's words? You have given the enemies of the Lord reason to blaspheme. Okay? That kind of a thing. It might be false teaching that's going on inside the church. And I picked on Joby last week. You know, Joby's the false teacher. Matt is not the seminarian. Matt's the new Christian. Matt's been influenced by Joby's false teaching. How do we handle that? Well, Joby's the offender, and if Matt is succumbing to the false teaching, he's the offended. How do we handle the offender? Well, there are two courses of actions. According to Matthew 18, the offender, the one who causes you to stumble, causes you to sin, is like the hand or the foot that has to be cut off. Okay. A member of the body is dismembered, and there are instances in Scripture where the error is great enough and already publicized that that's exactly what happens. We mentioned that the young man in 1 Corinthians 5 who's having a sexual ongoing affair with his own stepmother, and it's publicly known. Paul says that. It is commonly reported that there is fornication among you, and such as is not even named among the Gentiles, that a man has his own mother. And in this case, what we figure out from context is we're talking about stepmother, okay? His father's wife. All right, it's publicly known, it's ongoing, it's scandalous. What does Paul say? When you come together, deliver him to Satan. There's no process involved. There's no step one, step two. This has already reached the point where the hand or the foot is causing you to sin. Do something with it. Because a little leaven leavens the whole lump. Okay. Now, what do we do for the Christian or the professing Christian, the sheep who wanders astray because of this influence? We try to win them back. We go to them. We talk to them. We plead with them. Eventually, if necessary, we bring it to the church. But the goal of this is to win the sheep back. So in this case, Matt has succumbed to Joby's, what did I say, Arianism? I don't remember. Denies the second. Hyperpreterism. Okay, so he has succumbed to the hyperpreterism. Okay, so we cut off the hyperpreterism, but what do? We try to win the wandering sheep back. This is how Matthew 18 functions. The point of chapter 13 is this. While the church is working on such matters, be patient. Wait for the proceedings of the church. And when the church does deal with it properly, don't leave the church. In fact, rejoice that the church is handling the situation properly. That's a good thing. Okay? It's not, well, so-and-so got caught in some open sin, or so-and-so was caught teaching serious error. I'm going to go somewhere else. If the church handles it, that says something good about the church. Stay there if they're properly handling it. If they're seeking to recover the wandering sheep, then that means that one day, if you become the wandering sheep, they'll seek you out too. And there's comfort in that. All right, let's move on then to paragraph 14. Paragraph 12 and 13 then deals with events that take place within the context of a church. But are there issues that might transcend the proper realm for a church's own elders to handle? And what I'm looking for are some examples and what those examples might be. And I say, hint, see paragraph 15. So, right off top of your head or right off the top of reading paragraph 15, whichever one happens, what are some issues that a church's elders might say, we need more than just us to handle this? Yeah.
If there's a church down the road that proclaims to be a Reformed, covenantal Reformed Baptist church, and their elders start teaching some heresy, and some of our members are swayed by their teaching.
Okay. So if we talk about interchurch, false doctrine. Now, you specified a church that claims to be Reformed Baptist or something of that nature. And the reason you said that is simple. Are there lots of churches that might have false doctrine? But we don't have relationship with them. So am I going to try to convene a synod of Reformed churches to deal with the local United Universalist church? Well, I don't have any dealings with the Unitarian Universalist church. That's beyond our pale. Okay? Indeed, it might be advisable for several churches of the same mind to get together and to write a paper or to publicize an approach, why this is in error, why we're not going to follow it, and then publish it to all of the churches.
What about issues within the eldership?
Ah. What about issues with the eldership? So Matt, BJ, and I start teaching that there is no second coming. Okay, because Joby has affected us. It's Joby's fault. And we didn't do what we were supposed to do with Joby. So now we all have false doctrine and we start teaching that. What do you do? Well, first you're going to come talk to us, right? You're going to deal with our false teaching. But we don't repent. If there is another recourse, such as appealing to other churches in the association for them to come and advise what to do, that would be a good thing, wouldn't it? Yeah, you want someone who's going to have some expertise, and you want more than one. You want as wide of a group as possible from different churches to all come and look at the scenario. Okay? Yeah, when we get into paragraph 15, heads up, the word communion does not mean Lord's Supper.
Okay, so what does they mean by communion?
Fellowship, regular sharing together, regular meeting together, some sort of relationship, associational relationship, holding communion together. It's when we talk about church communion, we're not necessarily referring to the Lord's Supper. We may be referring to the sharing that we have, the commonality that we have of worshiping together, being members of the same church. Well, apply that to churches instead of individuals, and you get an idea of what communion would be. I'm not sure I understand that question.
So, would that mean that also how membership then is being handled amongst the different churches within the same group?
Well, there might be issues that relate to, and I'm going to go back to this one over here. What do you do if you have sin issues between members of different churches? So it involves more than one church, more than one eldership. Okay? Let me take you to Acts chapter 15. This is Acts 15:1. And when it says came down from Judea, okay, we think, oh, that means they went south, because we tend to think of up and down on the map. But came down actually refers to the fact that Judea is higher in elevation. And to come down from Judea, they're actually going north into the areas where Paul has been evangelizing. Most likely, the way I put it together anyway, is into the new churches that Paul has just planted in southern Galatia. Antioch, Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe. Probably Antioch of Syria is being affected as well. But the main thing is that Paul has won converts who were Gentiles or are Gentiles. Okay? Now, in the Old Testament, if someone converted to the worship of God, the the heads of the households were circumcised and they became Jews because the Jews were God's national chosen people. And so you have Jews who are believers in Judea, or at least professed believers, who assume that the same practice is taking place. I think there's more to it than that, but that'll give you a summary. So, Acts 15:1. Certain men came down from Judea and taught the brethren, unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. Got it? Therefore, when Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and dispute with them, they determined to go off and start their own denomination. They determined that they were going to have nothing more to do with the church of Judea and Jerusalem. What did they do? They sent Paul and Barnabas and certain others of them, and they would go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders about this question. So, being sent on their way by the church, they passed through Phoenicia and Samaria, describing the conversion of the Gentiles, and they caused great joy to all the brethren. Okay, so they're going through the churches of Phoenicia, Lower Syria, Samaria, where you have Jews who have been converted, and they're telling them about Gentiles who have been converted, but they're going to Jerusalem to discuss this very issue. And so when they came to Jerusalem, they were received by the church and the apostles and the elders. That's not just they shook their hands. There's a formal reception going on here. And they reported all things that God had done with them, but some of the sect of the Pharisees who believed rose up saying, it's necessary to circumcise them, the Gentiles who have converted. In other words, it's necessary that they be Jews and to command them to keep the law of Moses. And so the apostles and the elders came together to consider this matter. Okay? There's false doctrine that has arisen inside the church of Jerusalem. That false doctrine is now being spread to other churches. What do you do? Well, the churches come together to discuss it. All right, so, what kind of relationship exists between churches in order for there to be this kind of trust? Well, there has to be some kind of relationship. I'm not going to get into a church council with churches that I don't know, ministers to whom I've never met, whose doctrine is totally different from mine and with whom I have no relationship whatsoever. That's just simply not wise. And it's not biblical either. Okay? There has to be some sort of relationship. There has to be, to play off of what Cheryl was asking earlier, there has to be some sort of communion between the churches. All right, let's look at paragraph 14 then, and let's read it, and then I'll bring some points out here for you. As each church and all the members of it are bound to pray continually for the good and prosperity of all the churches of Christ in all places and upon all occasions, to further everyone within the bounds of their places and callings and the exercises of their gifts and graces. So, the churches, when planted by the providence of God so as they may enjoy opportunity and advantage for it, ought to hold communion among themselves for their peace, increase of love, and mutual edification. Period. You can tell a society is getting dumber when its sentences get shorter. And when we can't follow a train of thought. But let me go ahead and go through here first. First, I want to point out the obligation. Okay? Churches and Christians are obligated, they are bound to pray. Sorry, Cheryl. to pray continually for the good and prosperity of all the churches of Christ. Okay? That's not just a good thing, that's an obligation. We are bound to do that for each other. Churches should, biblically speaking, pray for each other. Okay? So note the obligation. Secondly, I want you to note the correlation. Okay? As each church is bound, so, okay, there's a corollary. If this is true, then this must be true also. Now, that pattern shows up back in paragraph 12 regarding the doctrine of church membership. So, if you will, I'm going to go back over here. Sorry about this, BJ. I know this makes some people a little bit carsick. But notice what you have here back in paragraph 12. As all believers, okay, are bound to join themselves to particular churches, so all that are admitted under the privileges of a church are under the church government. So paragraph 12 has this same obligation correlation logic to it, ratio. You have an obligation to join a church. What's the natural corollary of that? Well, if you are under Christ's authority to join a church, you're under Christ's authority when you join that church. Makes sense. Okay? So when we get over to paragraph 14, we have a very similar situation. As each church is obligated to pray for other churches, so then there's this extension that comes off of it. And so that extension is this. They ought to hold, let me get bigger here. They ought to hold communion among themselves. And we're talking about churches. Churches ought to be in a commonality, a common relationship. If you look at the word communion in the next paragraph, the next chapter, I mean, communion of the saints. Communion is defined as sharing in each other's gifts and graces and being a part of each other, members of one another. And so churches ought to share in each other's gifts and graces, and there ought to be some sort of a relationship or membership one of another. There are some limitations here. Yeah, what stops us from being ecumenicism in the full liberal sense of the word? Okay? First of all, this communion, if you will, is defined as being for their peace, increase of love, and mutual edification. Okay? I'm not holding communion with somebody who's not increasing the peace, love, and mutual edification of this church. If their doctrine is so far off, right, that instead of increasing the peace of this church, they're increasing the dissension. If they are in fact offending the members of the church by their false doctrine, or potentially offending it, if instead of building the church up, they're destroying it, I'm not holding communion. There's no basis for communion in that situation. Okay? So, you've got an obligation. Let me put it another way. What's the obligation? To pray continually for the good and prosperity of all the churches of Christ. Well, all right, let me just ask you a question. What if we're not dealing with a church of Christ? And I don't mean the denomination. What if it's a church that I cannot in good conscience pray that God would bless? I'm not having communion with them. That, you see the limitations of the paragraph that are involved here. Okay, so we have an obligation. There's a correlation. Because I have this obligation, so this is what should happen. Okay, Eric? Yeah. When I get to paragraph 15, I will. How does this fit in with a Baptist perspective regarding church autonomy? Quick answer, associations have no right to intrude upon local church autonomy in any way, shape, or form. When we get to paragraph 15, we'll see those limitations come out in the way it's worded. Okay. There's obligation, there's correlation. There is also the first three rules of business, right? Location, location, location. When planted by the providence of God so as they, what? May enjoy opportunity and advantage of such communion. Now you have to understand this is written in the 1600s. What is not available in the 1600s in terms of travel?
Airlines,
cars, highways, internet, Zoom. Okay? None of that. No email, no whatever. And so they're limited by geographical location. So they say, when by the providence of God, churches are planted in such a location that they may enjoy the opportunity and advantage of communing with each other. Okay? To them, that's a restriction. To us, it's not as great of a restriction, though it is somewhat. There are Reformed Baptist associations in Italy. There's one in Nepal. There's one in Ireland. There's one in New Zealand. I don't have a whole lot of communion with those guys. I get emails every once in a while. But that's it. Many of them I've never met. Okay. So there are still restrictions regarding location. But that's the idea. If the location is such that it allows a regular coming together for this mutual edification, then there ought to be, if possible, some sort of communion. Okay? All right, so those are the restrictions, if you will, of the doctrine that's involved.
So real world, like the practice of that, we should be getting together more
with the church itself, closer. Well, the churches ought to hold communion. Now, one of the ways that's done, for example, in the Texas Area Association, is there's an annual meeting where all the churches come together for a common worship meeting. It's a Sunday night service. It's always held at Heritage in Mansfield, because it's kind of centrally located for everybody to get to. All highways flow to Dallas-Fort Worth, so to speak. Trust me, when we have a quarterly meeting in Van, and Van is 4 hours one way through back roads, and then you have a 5 or 6 hour meeting, and then you have 4 hours back again, Matt comes out of it fine. I don't. Okay. It's an age thing. All right. So, that leads us then to paragraph 15. If there's the doctrine that churches should hold communion together, how does this work out? Well, I'm going to read the paragraph and then show you how it applies. In cases of difficulties or differences, either in point of doctrine or administration, wherein either the churches in general are concerned or any one church in their peace, union, and edification, or any member or members of any church are injured in or by any proceedings and censures not agreeable to truth and order, it is according to the mind of Christ that many churches holding communion together, and by the way, that's not an ingressive, that's an iterative. It's not, we just started holding communion together for this issue. It's, we've been in communion for some time now. We have a relationship. There is an association. There is a fellowship. Those churches who are already holding communion together, okay, do by their messengers meet to consider and give their advice in or about that matter in difference to be reported to all the churches concerned. Howbeit, here's your question. These messengers assembled are not entrusted with any church power properly so called, or with any jurisdiction over the churches themselves to exercise any censures either over any churches or persons, or to impose their determination on the churches or officers. Okay, yeah, go ahead. Correct. When we talk about, and let me see if I can get a nice, well, here, I'll just use the laser. When we talk about church power, properly so-called, okay, church power is the power of a church to exclude from its membership or to admit to its membership, right? But to exclude, to excommunicate, to exercise discipline, censures, okay? Any coming together for these purposes, that sort of group has no church power. And then to spell it out, what do you mean by that? Okay, they do not have any jurisdiction over the churches. They cannot exercise any censures. And those censures are not over the church or any person. The association cannot censure a church, and it cannot censure a person. What does it do? Well, by their messengers they meet to consider, and what? They give their advice. Okay, so you understand the limitations of what's going on. Let me, however, break it out, because this is really, you've got three ors here. This or this, point of doctrine or administration, wherein either the churches in general or any one of the churches, okay, and you've got these three combinations, this or this, this or this, this or this, and it actually creates, if you know your permutations in math, it actually creates eight possibilities plus one. Okay? I'm not sure why that decided not to write there at that point. Eight plus one. Okay? What are the eight possibilities? Well, first of all, there's the possibility that you might have a difficulty. A difficulty is, we're not sure what to do here. Let me give you an example. In the early years of the Baptist Association of Philadelphia, there was a church in the western part of Pennsylvania, which back then is like frontier. Now it's just Pittsburgh. But back then it was frontier. And this church had not actually had a full-time minister for 2 years. There is no other Baptist church in the area. It's amazing, isn't it? They hadn't even split yet. So there's this one solitary Baptist church on the western frontier of the colonies. We're not even the United States yet. This is before then. Okay? And they don't have a full-time pastor, and they haven't had one for a couple of years. So they write to the association and they say, would it be proper for us to attend church at a local Congregationalist church because at least there's preaching there? And the advice that comes back is, we don't think you should do that. Give us time to find somebody who can fill the pulpit. And their advice was based off of the idea that if you start going to the Congregationalist church, you and your kids are all going to become Congregationalists, and now there's not going to be a Baptist church. So, wait. And that was their advice. But it was advice. Difficulties. Difficulties can come in all kinds of ways. What do we do about this? This is something we didn't foresee. Maybe COVID. Should we shut down? To what degree do we cooperate? Those sorts of things. Differences is just what it says. There's a difference. It could be a difference that occurs within an eldership, a doctrinal difference. It could be a difference that occurs between churches. One church believes this, one church believes that. How are you going to handle that? The difficulty or the difference can come in the area either of doctrine or administration. There could be a difficulty of doctrine. We're wrestling with this really fine point about the eternal generation of the Son and whether the Father communicates only the person of the Son and relative properties, or does he communicate the essence of the divine Godhead as well? And what? Is there a difficulty? Okay, then maybe you ought to come together and talk about it. There could be a difference of doctrine. What about administration? Administration of the church. In particular, worship. Okay, so you have difficulty or differences. Those difficulties or differences could be either in doctrine or administration. And it might affect either the churches in general, or it might affect one church in its peace, union, and edification. Notice that restriction. If it affects one church, but it's not affecting that church's peace, union, or edification, it is not the business of the association. That local church handles its problem. But if it's of such a nature that it's disrupting that church, then it is advisable that that church's elders and people ask for advice from a larger set so that they can restore their peace, union, and edification rather than dissolve and split. Daniel. Yeah.
The nature of Christ, how is this idea different from church council?
Yeah. Let's take the first church council, the first general ecumenical church council, okay, the Council of Nicaea, AD 325. It's regarding whether or not the person of the Son is eternal or created. However, while I find the Nicene Creed and the Nicene Council very helpful and personally subscribe to the Nicene Creed, as well as the Ephesian, Constantinopolitan, and Chalcedonian, first four, there's a milieu that allows for the ecumenical councils that does not exist in Baptist theology. And that milieu is church-state, or state-church, better be a way of putting it. What allows them to have an ecumenical council in Nicaea in AD 325? It's the Roman Empire, and you got one guy at the top, Constantine, and he says, we're all going to believe the same thing. So all you bishops and all you pastors out there, We're meeting in Nicaea, or Nice, okay, and we're going to come together and we're going to solve this problem. Okay? Baptists don't do that. The Synod of Dort, right, over the issue of Arminianism. It's still a state church, even though it's reformed, okay, Dutch reformed. But they are able, by church, by national government, to say, we're going to come together. And by the way, we're inviting the Scots and the Irish and the English and the whoever else wants to attend, you know. But there's a state church background to this concept that we don't have. So while I can find such declarations helpful, and there's some really good theology, Baptists don't operate that way. We don't get to call national councils or ecumenical councils. Okay? What we're looking for is Baptist churches that hold communion together already, who can then come together for these kinds of problems. To create the confession? Well, there were seven churches that subscribed to the First Baptist Confession, 1644, with a second edition, 1646. There's debate about how the Second London Baptist is written, who's the primary author, probably Nehemiah Cox. But finally in 1689 is when it's published. And it's subscribed by, and I don't remember how many Baptist churches, over 100 in 1688, after the Glorious Revolution. So it's not where they all came together to write it. In the actual historical situation, it's written by a smaller group of men, most likely under direction of several churches or at the request of several churches. But again, history's a bit vague for us, I think. But could an association of Reformed Baptist churches come together and say, we need to define what that means? Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. So it's just for advice. Now, the Texas Area Association, because I wrote the Constitution to it, has a provision in it that says, in this kind of scenario, where the administration, where the association meets and gives its advice, so we're talking about a doctrinal difference or something of that nature, and a local church says, yeah, we're not going to take that advice, then in that scenario, the association has the right to say, well, okay, you can't be a member of the association anymore. Okay? So we've got these eight possibilities up top here. Then the confession adds one more. If there's any member or members of a church that are injured by procedures in censures not agreeable to truth and order, meaning your pastors have become authoritarian and unbiblical in the way they're handing out discipline. Okay, now you need a larger advice. Okay. The principle is that the issue at hand transcends the place of one church or one church's group of elders to handle properly and wisely. So what do you do? Well, if that church has been in regular communion with other churches of like mind and faith, then it is, according to the mind of Christ, according to the confession, to seek their advice. Some questions for you. I'm going to just rattle through these without comment. Notice some things here. First, if you will, many churches holding communion. How many? Many. More than one. Does that mean every single Reformed Baptist church in the entire nation? Well, no, not necessarily. Just the churches that are already holding communion together. Meaning, you're not seeking the advice of even of another Reformed Baptist church if you're not already in communion with them. Okay? There are lots of Reformed Baptist churches that I've never met the pastors. It really isn't a biblical or a wise thing for me to say, hey, we're having a problem. What do you think? I don't know the guy. Okay? Notice that when they meet with their messengers. Dorothy mentioned that, especially if you're dealing with a doctrinal issue, you want these to be pastors. It's not that all the members of all of the churches come together in one great big egalitarian democratic sort of a meeting and everybody, no, just the messengers. Each church sends messengers. Okay? It actually doesn't require pastors, but I think it assumes it. Just to point that out. And what do? Well, they give their advice. So there are limits to their advice. Okay. And then finally, this is reported to all the churches concerned. It's not reported to all the churches. It may not even be reported to all the churches in that association, unless the whole association met. Just to those churches that are concerned. Okay? So, some suggestions. How have Baptist churches done this in various ways, times past, divers manners? I'm going to have to rip through this, brother. Most common is the concept of a fellowship. A fellowship is a group of pastors. There's no formal structure. It's usually a pure democracy. Each pastor gets one vote. Okay? They don't really represent the churches. They just represent the pastors. There's no requirements for methodology. How do you vote? Is there a council? Is there a committee? Other than the moderation of the meetings and the votes that are taken, other than that, there's usually very little structure. If there are missions that are supported or seminaries, they are usually run by consent of the majority, but they're funded by individual church donations, and churches can decide if they want to contribute or not. It's very loose. Fellowships were all of the rage back in the 70s. Baptist fellowships. Baptist Bible Fellowship International. World Baptist Fellowship. Okay? International Baptist Fellowship. And fellowships are very loose, and groups come in and groups leave, and there's splits, and there's growth, and there's, you know, and everything is just kind of handled on a egalitarian, democratic, everybody gets one vote basis. If the fellowship wants to do something, there might be a group of churches over here that says, nah, I don't want anything part of that. We're not doing that. And that's fine. Okay? It protects Baptist autonomy, but it makes things a little difficult sometimes. Denominations, on the other side, a denomination is a formal structured entity that governs its member churches and usually stipulates some sort of doctrine and practice for all of the church members. Southern Baptists actually still have requirements to be a Southern Baptist. So, for example, churches that have ordained women pastors in the last 2 years have been removed from the Southern Baptist Convention. There is some doctrinal standard there. It's not a good full confession, but there's stuff there. And churches have been removed. There, in a denomination, there's usually some form of hierarchy. It doesn't have to be an absolute authority. So, for example, that hierarchy usually governs the denominational entities, if you're talking about Baptists. If you want to be a missionary with a Southern Baptist Convention, you don't just decide to be a missionary. Your church just doesn't decide to make you a missionary. You apply to either the North American Mission Board or the Foreign Mission Board, and you have to be approved by the Mission Board, and then you are funded out of the cooperative program, and they decide whether they're going to fund you or not. Okay? So who gets to be a missionary or a church planter is controlled by the convention. You can start your own seminary if you want to, but if you expect money, you have to get approval from the convention, because all the money comes into a cooperative program and the convention decides whether it's going to disperse that money or not. Denominations are very efficient, but they can also be top-heavy. Okay? Associations are kind of somewhere in between. There is a formal structured entity. It admits members. It might remove members. It's not a hierarchy of any kind, though. And so missions works and funding is handed with approval of the association as a clearinghouse, but there's still a voluntary contribution by the churches. Okay. So when ARPCA was in its existence, if you wanted to be an ARPCA missionary, what that meant was that the General Assembly approved of you. It was kind of putting a seal of approval on you. It was still up to the churches whether they wanted to support you or not. There's no cooperative program. But that seal of approval meant that you had been examined by the various committees. They had brought you before the association. They brought their recommendations. The association voted. Now you were an approved missionary or an approved whatever. Funding is still on the basis of voluntary funding. Let me run this out, close this out. Here are some applications. Churches should not be isolated. If at all possible, they should work together with other churches of like faith and practice. There was a time when there was a Reformed Baptist church, well, it's still there, in Idaho, and there were no other Reformed Baptist churches for, how far away was Mark Kelly from everybody else? A couple hundred miles or 150 or whatever. I guess Seattle would have been closer. So how far was, where was he in Idaho? It wasn't Boise. Port Cities. Port Cities, Idaho, how far is Port Cities, Idaho from Seattle? That's all the way across the state of Washington. That was the closest church. That's pretty isolated. He was able to get together once a year with the General Assembly, and that was it. So they should work together, if at all possible, in God's providence. Baptist churches are not a hierarchy. There's no authority over us as a church. There may be occasions when a church seeks the advice of other churches that it has communion with already. Here's what this means to you. As long as we're members of an association, if you believe your pastors are guilty of serious error or that we have practiced unbiblical discipline, you have the right, after speaking with your pastors, to ask our associations to meet and give their advice. Now, the way you do that is you contact the pastor of another church in the association and you ask him to bring it up to the association. Okay? But should we ever become dictatorial, unbiblical in our teaching, unbiblical in the way we handle discipline, there is a recourse. That recourse consists of advice. It can't force the church to do anything, but it is there. Okay, I'm way past time. So thank you for your patience. Thank you, brother. I apologize. But let's have a word of prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for the church. We live in an age where people look at the concept of Christian churches and they see disunity and fracture. They see doctrine that is scattered all over the spectrum. Much of it, Father, is outside the teaching of your word. It's serious error or heresy. Father, even among those who holds the authority of your word, there are differences. We ask, Father, that you will teach us to trust in you. Your church will not be prevailed against. Your church will never be conquered. There will always be a kingdom of Jesus Christ in this world. There will always be people who are brought into that kingdom. And it is by your sovereign providence that things occur as they do. So teach us not to despair, but to trust in you, to look to you, and to find our final comfort, not in a church, but in Christ who died for the church and the Spirit who indwells us. We ask that you will make us humble people who do all things according to the authority and guidance and teaching of your word. To that end, we pray you will bless the preaching of the word now. In Jesus' name, amen.